Right. Welcome to this, the second of two lectures on technology. Last lecture, we talked about technology S-curves and discontinuities and what they mean for an industry's development. And we talked about how both things are affected by the potential applications that people see for technologies and all the imperfections that characterize that process. We did that with lots of links back to the first lecture, to ideas about creative destruction, the productivity dilemma, and exploration and exploitation. This time, we're going to build on those understandings, and we're going to look at some specific cases of technological discontinuities in industrial development. We'll be talking about types of technological change that fall a little outside the conventional mold. For today, we've read a chapter by Clayton Christensen from his book, The Innovator's Dilemma. We're going to start with that, and then we're going to take the following text in the following order. We'll talk about Henderson and Clark on architectural innovation. We'll talk about David's paper on general purpose technologies. And finally, we'll do a real historical deep dive with Vincenti and his work on technological interdependence in airplane landing gear. But we're going to start off with Christensen. I should say that I'm going to break up the lecture in four parts. So there's going to be one for each paper, basically. And I think that they're going to last a little under half an hour each. Okay, so let's start off with Christensen. This is going to be about architectural innovation. And we're dealing here with the kind of technological change that is particularly difficult for organizations to deal with. And we're going to dive into what that is and why it is going to be so challenging. That's going to have parallels to architectural innovation that we will return to shortly. But for now, we're going to start off with disruptive innovation. Now, disruptive innovation is probably one of those ideas about innovation that is best known to the general public. But it's also an idea that has kind of mutated and lost most of its meaning in the process of becoming known. So what we're going to do here is we're going to try to be a little bit hardline in our definitions. We're going to be maybe a little bit too rigid, and we're going to focus quite specifically on what Christensen actually is saying and what he's trying to argue about disruptive innovation. You should be like really cognizant up front that he applies it in a very, very technically specific sense. And lots of the examples that you generally hear where people are claiming to be doing in disruptive innovation or relating to disruptive innovation in some sense is taking a much broader view and defining disruptive innovation much, much more loosely, but are keeping the same kind of assuming that the implications are going to be the same. And that's generally not going to hold particularly well. Okay, Christensen is using it in a very narrow sense and saying that in that narrow sense, disruptive innovation can have big, big implications. And what most people are doing is saying that is using disruptive innovation in a very loose sense, a very broad sense, and claiming still that the same kind of implications happen. And that's just not good form. So, as I mentioned, we're going to be a little bit rigid. We're going to look at specifically what he's saying, and then we're going to kind of take that argument and say, why is it that this can have the kind of implications that he argues? Basically, what Christensen is interested in is the fact, and that is a fact, that good businesses die. Not just any business, not just businesses doing well, but really excellent businesses, right? So this is a Schumpeterian thing, right? How is it that even those organizations that do best, the ones that are most applauded, most lauded in their time, still fall under the sweep of creative destruction? Why is it that companies, at the moment that they are praised most, are also, as it turns out, being undermined? And that the very best managers with the very best tools, in lead of the best organizations, just when things are going best, in reality, are most being set up for ruin? Those companies that should at least ostensibly be most resistant to creative destruction still fall prey to it. How can that be? Right? That's the question that motivates Christensen in this exploration. in a sense, this can, in a Schumpeterian sense, this is not really deeply surprising, right? Schumpeter would probably say that there is no company that has endured forever. All companies eventually fail. But if we look at it a little bit closer, it can actually seem very counterintuitive. Who, for instance, would today plausibly imagine that Google will not exist in 20 years, right? We talked a little bit about that dilemma in last class, that there are advantages of being an incumbent and there are disadvantages. But there are basically lots of reasons to think that an established player, an incumbent, will be in a position that can be hard to shift. So the kind of question here is, when are the benefits of incumbency, and especially the kind of leading excellent incumbency that Christensen is concerned about, when does that actually end up not being enough to defend a position, right? So imagine Google, right? On the one hand, that company seems absolutely invincible. In most countries, it's a verb, and not just a company, and it's also kind of taking on this role as essential infrastructure. It's what makes the web accessible to us. In lots of ways, their dominance over internet search as a market seems almost total, and their dominance over the online advertising space is this duopoly with Facebook, and Facebook might be in worse times than they've ever been, but still they're kind of holding on to that pretty well. What Google is doing also is that they are just utilizing data streams in this incredibly well-designed way. Their diversification is so complete that there seems no real way that they're going to be outcompeted anytime soon. But on the other hand, you can kind of look at history and say, has there ever been a company that has not eventually gotten outperformed? And history basically is full of examples of this. Full of examples of companies that seem totally invincible, but end up being anything but, right? That end up being outcompeted and ousted from their incumbent position. You should be kind of pretty well equipped at this stage to understand why established companies would be outcompeted, right? Schumpeter would just see it as a natural thing. It's how market economies function. It's the essence of capitalism. Abernathy would see it kind of as a result of excessive focus on process innovation and efficiency. There is some truth to that in Google. The organization is becoming so specific that it's not going to be able to compete with new forms of emerging technology. And March would probably just see it as an overweight of short-term exploitation, a success trap that you fall into, that you kind of end up eating the grain that you should have used to sow for next year, if we kind of push into a little bit of a rural metaphor. With Foster and Abernathy, we would just see it as a result of technological discontinuities, which apparently, at least when they're competence-destroying, are going to be very difficult to handle. So we can think about that, but it's kind of obviously the case that organizations eventually fail. That kind of happens. But why is it that even those who are ostensibly best, who are in the best position to be innovating, to be at the forefront of their industries, and to continuously stay at the forefront of their industry, also get displaced? How come nobody makes this, right? How come? I mean, that's a pretty deep point, right? That nobody makes it out alive, at least if they stay in the game for long enough, right? Okay, so Christensen's argument basically is that the reason these firms fail, the reason an excellent firm is going to fail, is going to be because of disruptive innovation, right? And you can see why kind of disruptive innovation can capture the popular imagination, right? It's going to be something that's going to be very fearful, very anxious, right? It's going to be something that all firms are going to be concerned about. All the more the firms that consider themselves excellent and leading in their industries, because maybe they're doing something that's eventually going to sow the seed of their destruction. This idea, right, disruptive innovation is going to bring down the best companies has a certain dramatic flair. And just at a term level, it's a little more catchy and accessible than competence destroying technological discontinuities or general purpose technologies, which is often what it sometimes gets confused with. That's a non-trivial confusion because there are going to be very different mechanisms at stake in the three things. So let's just focus in. What does Christensen actually mean by disruptive innovation? Right, so there are two critical factors in the definition of disruptive innovation. One part of the definition is that there's some kind of a technological discontinuity at play, right? It's going to be a technological breakthrough, a jump to a new S-curve, a paradigm shift, right? In Christensen's terminology, there's going to be a break between sustaining innovations that an industry has been pursuing, and there's going to be a transfer to some kind of new direction, right? So sustaining innovations are kind of the type of innovations that stay within the established paradigm, the established order of the industry. A disruptive innovation is going to be something that shifts to a whole new way of operating, right? Paradigm shift, technological discontinuity, new S-curve, right? So it's going to be that technological shift. The second factor, and this is really important and key to understanding why disruptive innovation can have the kind of impact it can, right? It's often overlooked, but it's essential to understanding the kind of causality that gets attributed to disruptive innovations, right? That second factor is that disruptive innovation is based on the existence of a group of customers who are currently being not being served by existing solutions. People who want to use a solution but can't because maybe it's too expensive, it's over-serving what they need, right? So there's going to be, in order for disruptive innovation to really do the kind of things that people are expecting it to do, there needs to be a group of customers who find that the solutions available in the market, the solutions based on current technologies, are too expensive because they deliver more than this group of unserved users need, right? Imagine that there are customers who need a moped, but the only thing they can buy is a fully fledged motorcycle. You can imagine that there might be customers who need a fly swatter, but the only thing they can buy is a bazooka, right? Like the kind of thing you need, the problem you need to be solved, is only getting solved by these really high-end solutions, right? You might need a pair of earphones. The only thing you can buy is a surround sound system, right? Somebody might be happy for an air mattress in the living room, but you can only stay at the Hilton, right? Existing solutions from established players, in order for there to be disruptive innovation, have to be over-designed and over-fulfilling the needs of the low end of the market. When that phenomenon happens, right, when you have this group of overlooked, underserved customers, overlooked and overserved customers not using the product but wanting to use some of it, it's because established companies are busy not only perfecting the technology that they already have, right, that's part of the explanation that fits with Abernathy's ideas, but it's also this thing that established companies would like to deliver to the top of the market, to pursue the most attractive customers, to pursue the highest possible margins, right? So that's the core of disruptive innovation, right? There's going to be a mismatch between the development of the offered technological performance and the demand for performance, right? So the key of disruptive innovation, in order for an innovation to be disruptive, in Christensen's sense, it has to deliver a lower quality to a less attractive customer group, right? We know about new technologies delivering lower quality from Foster's idea of discontinuities, right? But the idea in disruptive innovation is that some technologies use that lower quality initially to pursue less attractive customers, right? So what you see is that when disruptive innovation occurs, new players in an industry use a technological discontinuity to address these less attractive customers, and they use those non-attractive customer groups to gain a foothold in the market. And from there, they're basically riding up a new S-curve with lots of improvement potential. They're developing their product to be better than established players, than what established players are offering. And then they can take over not only the low end of the market, but also the high end of the market, right? And from that, they can kind of scale up to market dominance, displacing what was there before. But the key idea is that in order for it to be disruptive, in Christensen's sense, you have to use a new technology to start in the low end, unattractive market that established actors are not interested in. And that's the essence of disruption. That's why established players get challenged by this, because precisely of a new technology entering in the lower end of the market, right? So notice in this sense that a company like Uber, for instance, is in technical terms not disruptive, right? What they started doing was offering an exclusive product that was better than taxis, right? And then later they kind of pivoted to a more disruptive strategy, but basically that low end of the market is what makes disruptive innovation capable of being so difficult for incumbents, right? Now there's a real kind of ongoing discussion, as you would sort of expect, in innovation research about Christensen's definition of innovation as being perhaps too narrow in relation to the phenomenon of creative destruction, essentially, that he's describing. And a good part of that debate, I think, is if you look at Ezra Sukerman's paper, it's called Crossing the Chasm to Disruptive Innovation. It's from 2016, and it's published in MIT Sloan Management Review. And that's really a good exemplary paper about the broader understanding of Christensen's argument that many are arguing for. But we're going to stay with the narrow definition. And the reason we're going to do that is because it has kind of a pretty significant implication. I'm going to quote from Christensen's conclusion, right? Disruptive innovation should be framed as a marketing challenge, not a technological challenge. It's about market creation more than technology. And that market creation is going to be about creating a market in the unserved end of established markets, right? Now, that's important because while we already know that it's difficult to relate to technological discontinuities, it's precisely the marketing component of disruptive innovation that makes it particularly difficult for established and well-run companies to deal with, right? Because if established companies, if incumbents are going to be engaging with disruptive innovation, they have to explore in a very particular kind of way, right? They have to allocate resources to explore and engage customers where it's not really uncertain whether they're going to be profitable. It's quite clear that they're unprofitable and unattractive right now, both in terms of the size of the market, which is going to be small, and the profit margins that are also going to be small. Right, so this is a losing deal for established companies. But both in terms of volume of the market and the profit margins, it's going to be too small for an established and dominant company to deal with. It's going to be a bad deal going in and serving that market. Right? They would much rather serve the large market or the very high end of the market, either because the volume is going to be larger in the mainstream market, or because the profit margin is going to be much higher in the high end, right? So what a firm has to do if they want to engage with disruptive innovation is to allocate resources away from things that work, from things that are profitable, because they're basically using known technology and using it to serve the most attractive customers, and then they have to give it to something that is, it's not uncertain whether it's unattractive. It's actually obvious that it's unattractive. But the implication, of course, is that some disruptive innovations grow from those low-end markets to market dominance, in which case the kind of implication that can come from it, distant in time and highly uncertain, of course, can be transformative for an industry, right? So while exploring in a general sense, engaging in exploration can feel like a costly and uncertain affair, disruptive innovation is going to feel like in many cases a total waste, right? You're going to not only be doing something that might pay off, you're going to be doing something that seems overwhelmingly wasteful, right? And especially in light of the fact that the overwhelming majority of innovations, despite what you often hear, are actually not particularly disruptive but very sustaining, it becomes even more difficult, right? How do you spot that new technology, that new market opportunity that will grow into being disruptive? That's going to be very difficult. But it's the epitome in this understanding of creative destruction. And it's a big part of the explanation why the dominant and the best-run companies are brought to their knees, precisely because they're not able to make that switch to engaging with low-end, poorly functioning technologies, right? The idea that you should be thinking about here is, if we kind of stay within March's framework, that there's going to be a trade-off between exploration and exploitation. We know that, right? The way that's going to look in the case of disruptive innovations is that there's going to be cannibalization between departments and between technologies and between markets, right? So you're going to have, in the same organization, you're going to have a part of the organization using the established technologies. They're going to be using that, and they're going to be using that to serve well-functioning markets. And now they are going to be competing for resources with a new department, possibly using a new technology that's going to be poorly functioning, obviously poorly functioning relative to what is already there. And it's going to be serving a market that's not particularly interesting or particularly attractive. So firms in that situation are in principle competing with themselves. They're going to tend to prioritize well-functioning units and production processes that have been invested in considerably over several years of development. Those units are going to be competing with the units that are addressing customers who are not particularly attractive, that don't represent a particularly good business proposition, and where the technology doesn't really seem particularly good or particularly promising, right? The thing is, of course, that some technologies and some customer groups have the potential to develop. And develop, of course, to a point where they displace what is already there, right? So the thing is, so in this sense, all the things that an organization can have gotten good at, all the capabilities that they could have developed to serve those high-end customers with the very well-functioning technology can suddenly become a disability, right? Because it increases the liability of investing in these new opportunities, these low-end technologies. And that's kind of one of Christensen's better points, is that capabilities, the things that companies are able to do, tend to be very specific and very specialized, more so than managers often imagine, and that those capabilities can become disabilities in trying to deal with new technologies and new opportunities. Right, so capabilities are something that exist in both humans and the organization, right? Christensen is going to argue that people are relatively easy to train. I don't know if that's necessarily true. An awesomely great engineer can be a really mediocre user and developer of other technologies. I think that's kind of the empirical picture, but leave that aside. But basically, what he argues is that people can be relatively easily retrained. You can use people to do new things. The problem is that organizational cultures and processes are not like individuals, and they're going to be very difficult to move once they're determined. We'll return to that point in the Henderson and Clark paper in just a minute. Basically, what you want to think about is that all those things that the organization has gotten good at, all those capabilities that have been built up by serving high-end customers, developing technologies are going to be, in some cases, a disability as you try to deal with new and emerging technologies, right? Why do I spend so much time riffing on this definition of disruptive innovation? I mean, that's a totally fair question. I do so because I think it's one of the things that you should be able to do from this course, right? Basically, everyone can have an opinion of innovation. Everyone can have a sense of what disruption is. But the key idea of knowing something is to know it not just as a at a factual level, but also to know why, right? To have a justified belief about what is the case. And basically, most people's definition of disruption is not justified at all. And that's kind of what we're trying to push you to have here, right? If you don't have a solid grasp of what it is that you're actually talking about, it's difficult to know anything about it in a systematic way. And so that's why we're kind of trying to make you really aware of what is actually the real content of an idea. And why is it that it can have the kind of causal effects that people think it could have, or the kind of affordances that it could have? And what is it that, what are the ideas that just get thrown around? Okay, so moving on, right? There are a couple of things that are worth noting about disruption in this technical sense that we're trying to use it, right? You should know that the theory of disruption is very, very widely accepted, very, very widely recognized, but also that it has come under quite a lot of intellectual pressure. In 2014, the Harvard historian Jill Lepore wrote a great article called The Disruption Machine. And basically what she does is she looks at lots of the facts that Christensen is basing his argument on. And what she finds is that they don't really hold up on closer inspection. That's something that sometimes happens. Actually, it happens relatively frequently in social science. And so there is some pressure on whether the facts that his and that Christensen's analysis is based on is actually particularly good. I think, from my point of view, the argument that he puts forth is too clean and stylized in terms of what he's trying to explain, right? For me, the question of why good companies fail is hugely complex, and it has many, many more moving parts that are important to the outcome than what Christensen acknowledges, right? So basically, if something is going to be, if a dominant company is going to be disrupted, for me at least, it tends to be about much, much more than just a new technology coupled with this low-end market entry strategy. If, for instance, you look at it, something that's often touted as an example of disruption, namely Netflix's defeat of Blockbuster, it's pretty clear if you look into the details of how that industry transition happened that it's not just about discontinuity in market, right? If I was just going to give you kind of a headline story, it's clear that disruptive innovation is there, right? Streaming technology overcomes physical businesses, and that Netflix successfully understands how to hit millennials as the first group, and later as the central group, right? So that's kind of a low-end market that grows into market dominance, and that the streaming technology is a fundamental part of serving that group and expanding beyond it as the technology improves, right? That's pretty clear. But on closer inspection, that might be part of the reason why Netflix defeats Blockbuster, but there's so much more to it, right? A basic fact, Netflix did not even start out being a streaming service. It was just a company that rented out DVDs via website. And the main competition with Blockbuster was not on streaming, it was on video rental. And the question was whether that was supported by in-store physical shops or online, where it was something that you ordered and then sent DVDs back, right? Moreover, in the 7 years in which Netflix and Blockbuster were kind of slugging it out, there was a whole range of, I would say, pretty complex sociological and psychological dynamics in play in both organizations. And a big part of why Blockbuster was not able to deal with Netflix could very well be that there were a whole range of internal conflicts and conflicts between senior executives and external activist investors that were kind of pushing Blockbuster to compete in particular ways that may not have been what they really wanted and what was most meaningful, right? If you're interested in this, come and ask me. I'll provide some references to where you can look into these dynamics in greater detail. But basically, the key idea here is that while from a distance it is quite obvious that disruptive innovation was at work, on closer examination it becomes clear that there are many, many more things interacting to lead to this this outcome of disruption, right? Okay. That said, right, even in light of the challenge that Christensen's ideas are being put under as regard their data, and even if you kind of say that there's much, much more to the explanation than just technology and market entry, right, there are still pretty good reasons to take Christensen's idea seriously. For nothing else, you want to take it seriously because so many people are talking about it. But basically, there are some... the way I think it's most meaningful to understand innovation in this disruptive sense is that this falls somewhat outside of the... outside of the scope of this particular course, but I'm going to refer you to the book on entrepreneurial strategy by Scott Stern and Joshua Gans. That's going to be very helpful as you think about entrepreneurship in general. It's available for free online, which is of course the way to go. There are two perspectives in that book that I'd like to just cover in broad strokes with regard precisely to disruption, right? So one is that disruptive innovation often benefits from the fact that it simply doesn't make sense for established actors to compete with a disruptive entrepreneur, a disruptive innovation, right? By definition, the market for a disruptive innovation, that low end of the market, is going to be trivial to the market leader, right? Low margins and small market size. That has some pretty interesting implications, which you can drill down further on if you're interested. But basically the way to think about it is that disruptive innovation for an entrepreneur, at least for a new innovator, is that it's pretty much a game plan, right? This idea that the way to enter a market with a new technology is to address an unattractive market niche initially is pretty much a playbook for entrepreneurship, right? There's a strategy for how to introduce innovations to the market in that, right? You can exploit, so to speak, this fact, this phenomenon that it's not going to be particularly meaningful for an incumbent to work with a new technology or to address that market. Right, and that's kind of a way to think about how do we gain entry into a market and how do we gain a foothold, what's going to be our beachhead, and how do we scale from there. That, of course, kind of raises a question of how you move from a niche market to a mainstream market. We're going to get back to that as we discuss marketing of new technologies. But suffice to say that there's a way to think about disruptive innovation not so much as something that destroys incumbent companies, but more as a playbook for entrepreneurship, right? All right. With that, I'm going to close this round, and then we will move on to Henderson and Clark's paper.